thanks for the introduction. As you just heard, I'm the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis is one of the 12 regional reserve banks that, along with the Board of Governors, make up the Federal Reserve System. The Minneapolis Bank is the headquarters of the system's operations in the 9th of the 12 districts. And this district is a far-flung one. It includes Montana, the Dakotas, Minnesota, northwestern Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So one of the aspects of my job that I really like the most is the opportunity to visit communities across the 9th District. And I've had the pleasure of visiting, traveling to each state in the district in my nearly 2 years as president. But this is my first trip to Bismarck in that pond. It's not my first trip to Bismarck overall. I can talk to you about having stayed in the, what it's like to stay in the Bismarck KOA later. But I want to express my thanks to the National Association of State Treasurers for this invitation. And I also want to extend my thanks to the area business and civic leaders who have taken their time from their busy schedules to meet with me today to discuss the area's economic conditions, as well as those who will join me later this afternoon to tour areas that have been hit hard by this year's Missouri River flooding. The flooding experienced by North Dakota communities, most notably along the Missouri and Souris Rivers, but also along other state waterways, has dealt an unfortunate economic setback to many cities in a state that has otherwise experienced very good economic outcomes in recent years. We have been monitoring the impact of the 2011 floods in the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and will continue to do so in North Dakota, as well as Montana and South Dakota. But it will be some time before we have a complete reckoning of all the associated costs. But one thing I think does seem certain, the same cooperative attitude and resilience that has characterized communities' responses to the flooding suggests that their recovery will be a strong one. In his History of North Dakota, Elwin B. Robinson cites a late 19th century British statesman who described the prevailing spirit of optimism of the people who settled west of the Mississippi. "Men seem to live in the future," said this statesman, "rather than in the present. Not that they fail to work while it is called for today. They see the country not merely as it is, but as it will be 20, 50, or 100 years hence." Now, I have to say that I'm reasonably confident that Mr. Robinson would view this as an awkward segue, but his quote is also instructive to the operations of monetary policy. "The Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, meets 8 times per year to set the path of monetary policy over the next 6 to 7 weeks. All 12 presidents of the various regional Federal Reserve Banks, including myself, and the 7 governors of the Federal Reserve System, including Chairman Ben Bernanke, contribute to these deliberations." Now, I said 7 governors. Actually, right now, there are only 5 governors. There are 2 unfilled positions at the moment. The committee itself, the people who vote on monetary policy, actually consists of the governors, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and a rotating group of 4 other presidents. And that rotating group this year includes the presidents of Minneapolis, Philadelphia, Dallas, and Chicago. Now, as I said, this committee meets 8 times per year. And its deliberations at that time concern the appropriate readjustment of monetary policy to the new information received since the last meeting. But as I just talked about the early settlers of our great continent, the committee has to keep in mind the medium-term and indeed long-term goals that it has when it makes those readjustments. And it must also keep in mind the public's understanding of those goals. So this will be the theme of one of the key themes of my talk, this perspective that good policy responds to the current conditions so as to achieve certain well-communicated future goals will be a key theme, as I say, for the remainder of my remarks. They will be divided into 3 parts. The first part is about the FOMC's objectives and my thoughts regarding them. In the second part, I discuss the FOMC's performance relative to those goals in the past 3.5 years since the beginning of the Great Recession. Finally, I close with an analysis of the recent FOMC decision making. And here, I have to admit that my discussion is perhaps a little more disengaged than usual, since I dissented from, that is, formally disagreed with, the last FOMC decision. Given that, it seems especially apropos to remind you that my remarks today reflect my thoughts alone, not necessarily those of others in the Federal Reserve System, including my colleagues on the Federal Open Market Committee. Let me get some. Let me turn first to a discussion of FOMC objectives. Congress has mandated that the Federal Reserve set monetary policy so as to promote price stability and maximum employment. In my view, the heart of the price stability mandate is to formulate and communicate an objective for inflation. The central bank then fulfills its price stability mandate by making choices over time so as to keep inflation close to that objective. Of course, the central bank's job is complicated by economic shocks that may lower or raise inflationary pressures. The central bank provides additional monetary accommodation, like lowering interest rates, in response to shocks that push down on inflation. It reduces accommodation, raising interest rates, in response to shocks that push up on inflation. By doing so, it works to ensure that inflation stays close to its objective. Now, as I said, though, it's not enough to have an objective. The Federal Reserve must also communicate that objective clearly. That communication is what serves to anchor medium-term and long-term inflationary expectations. Let me put this another way. Without a clear communication of objectives, the public can only guess at the intentions of the FOMC. Inflationary expectations, inflation itself, will inevitably end up fluctuating, and possibly by a lot. Now, as I'll discuss later, it is possible to undo these kinds of shifts in expectations, but only at significant economic cost. Now, the Federal Reserve communicates its objective for inflation in a number of ways. For example, at quarterly interviews, FOMC meeting participants, the 12 presidents, the 5 governors, publicly reveal their forecasts for inflation 5 years hence, under the assumption that monetary policy is optimal. These forecasts usually range between 1.5% and 2% per year. So they're often collectively referred to by saying that the Federal Reserve views inflation as being, and here this is the Fed speak, mandate consistent if it is running at 2% or a bit under. But the Fed has also communicated its intentions more directly and more broadly. So last December, December 2010, for example, on the television program 60 Minutes, Chairman Bernanke did an interview in which he explained the dangers of letting inflation fall too low relative to 2% or a bit under range. But in the same interview, he also emphasized that the FOMC is unwilling to allow inflation to rise above this range. As I'll describe in more detail later in my speech, the economy was hit in the last 3.5 years by shocks that had the potential to drive inflation significantly downward. I believe that the FOMC's clear communication of its inflation objective has helped the FOMC keep inflation from falling too low in the face of those shocks. At the same time, the clear communication of its objective has also allowed the FOMC to follow highly accommodative monetary policies by keeping interest rates nearly at zero for nearly three years, without triggering large upward movements in inflationary expectations. I've been emphasizing the importance of communication. And communication matters greatly. But ultimately, the public's beliefs about the FOMC's inflation objective will also depend on outcomes. If annual inflation were to average less than 1.5% per year for more than 3 or 4 years, onlookers would begin to suspect the FOMC's true objective for inflation is actually lower than it's declared, 2% or a bit under. Correspondingly, if inflation is persistently higher than 2%, then the public will begin to believe that the FOMC's true objective for inflation is higher than 2%. In either case, inflation expectations could become unmoored, and the FOMC could lose control of inflation itself. Communication can only be effective if the FOMC also retains credibility. Now, as I mentioned, Congress has also mandated that the FOMC set monetary policy so as to maintain, to promote maximum employment. Now, in the past, some have seen an intrinsic conflict between the FOMC's price stability mandate and its maximum employment mandate. In contrast, my thinking accords with the more modern viewpoint that there's relatively little tension between these goals. The modern paradigm recognizes that monetary policy should allow the natural supply and demand forces in the economy to operate without impediment. For example, if energy costs spike, the basic forces of supply and demand dictate that firms will cut back on production and demand less labor, creating higher unemployment. It is inefficient for any policy, including monetary policy, to attempt to interfere with this natural adjustment process. It follows that the Federal Reserve's operational definition of max employment has to vary over time in response to economic shocks. Nonetheless, this modern paradigm to which I'm referring does view price stability as playing a crucial role in ensuring maximum employment. It is well documented that different firms adjust their prices at different times and in different ways in response to the ebb and flow of inflationary pressures in the economy. This asynchronous adjustment of prices across firms generates inefficiencies, including losses of employment. By ensuring that prices follow a steady, well-understood path, the Federal Reserve eliminates the variation in inflationary pressures and the need for firms to respond to that variation. In this way, the Federal Reserve's mission of achieving price stability is entirely consistent with its mission of achieving maximum employment. But there is another deeper sense in which the price stability and maximum employment mandates are intertwined. And this is a point I will come back to a couple of more times in my talk about how this deeper way in which the price stability mandate and the maximum employment mandate actually work together. Imagine that inflation were to run at 3 or 4% per year for 3 or 4 years. As I talked about earlier, the public will then start to doubt the credibility of the Fed's stated commitment to a 2% or a bit under inflation objective. The public's medium-term inflationary expectations will consequently begin to rise. As we saw in the latter part of the 1970s, these changes in expectations can serve to augment and reinforce the upward drift in inflation itself. At that point, the Federal Reserve will have to tighten policy considerably if it wishes to regain control of inflation. But we learned in the early 1980s that the resultant tightening, while necessary, generates large losses in employment. In other words, failing to meet its price stability mandate can also lead the FOMC, over the medium and long term, to substantial failures on its employment mandate. An important communication challenge for the FOMC is that it's much harder to quantify the max employment mandate than the price stability mandate. I've already talked about how a change in energy costs can push down on maximum employment. But changes in minimum wages, demography, taxes and regulations, technological productivity, job market efficiency, unemployment insurance benefits, entrepreneurial credit access, and social norms, and that's a partial list, all influence what we might consider maximum employment. Trying to offset these changes in the economy with monetary policy can lead to that dangerous drift in inflation expectations and ultimately inflation itself. So that's My thoughts on the so-called dual mandate of the Federal Reserve, price stability and maximum employment. Price stability, we communicate our objective and then take actions to follow through on that communication and on that objective. The two mandates work together, and particularly in the sense that failing to meet our price stability mandate can lead us to have to tighten to control inflation expectations and cause large employment losses. So with that said, I now want to talk about monetary policy over the last 3.5 years since the Great Recession. So as I talked about earlier, the Federal Reserve is mandated to set policies to promote price stability. So I'm going to ask the question, how's the Fed done? How has it done in terms of its price stability mandate since the Great Recession began in December 2007? The answer is remarkably well. The personal consumption expenditure, PCE, inflation rate, has averaged 1.8% per year from the fourth quarter of 2007, when the recession is usually, is dated as it started, through the second quarter of 2011. So I'll say that again. Go to the end of the beginning of the recession to the second quarter of 2011, inflation has averaged 1.8% per year. I would say that this outcome is essentially consistent with price stability, that 2% or a bit under that I talked about earlier. Now, this admirable performance is not due to luck. Since mid-2006, residential land prices have fallen by over 50%. And these falling land prices were at the heart of the financial crisis that hit the world from 2007 to 2009. And they've generated a persistent fall in wealth and in borrowing capacity for households. The associated declines in demand for consumption goods and investment goods pushed downward on prices and inflation. It's confronted with this enormous shock to the economy, the Federal Reserve has followed an unprecedentedly and unimaginably accommodative policy. It has kept interest rates near zero. It has provided forward guidance by explicitly expressing its expectation that interest rates would stay extraordinarily low for an extended period. It has bought over $2 trillion worth of longer-term government securities. Through these actions, the Fed has provided an extraordinary amount of stimulus. And that is what has allowed the Fed to meet its price stability mandate. But what about the future? I've talked about what's happened in the past. What about the next few years? Well, here, of course, we don't know what's going to happen. And there are a number of different ways to measure inflation expectations, which all unfortunately come with a caveat, I would say. Last December, a Cleveland Fed study analyzed several such measures, inflationary expectations. And it concluded that the Survey of Professional Forecasters, which is a survey done by the Philly Fed, those projections tend to forecast inflation relatively well. The most recent SPF survey, which was conducted before the August FOMC meeting, predicted that PC inflation will average 2.1% per year for the next 5 years. So in the face of challenging circumstances, the Federal Reserve has met its price stability mandate and is expected to continue to do so. Now, unemployment does remain disturbingly high. Yet I am sure it would be even higher without the enormous amount of monetary stimulus that the FOMC has provided. Moreover, and this is important, I believe that the FOMC could only have systematically lowered the unemployment rate further by generating inflation rates higher than 2% over a multi-year period. Such an outcome could well lead the public to lose faith in the credibility of the FOMC's inflation objective, and thereby increase the probability that the FOMC would lose control of inflation. And as I stressed earlier, this scenario would require a policy response that would generate substantial losses in employment. I've talked about the price stability mandate, maximum employment mandate, and I've talked about the last 3.5 years and how the Fed has used, unprecedented and imaginative levels of accommodation in order to keep inflation at 2% or a bit under. Now I'd like to turn my assessment to the most recent round of FOMC decision making that took place 3 weeks ago. Now, to put this part of my talk in the proper context, I want to ask another key question. How did the FOMC achieve its success over the past 3.5 years with regard to price stability? The answer, I believe, is that the FOMC consistently made choices in response to changes in short-term economic conditions that were designed to support its medium-term inflation objectives. Now, getting these choices right is more of an art than a science. I showed this to an economist friend, the speech ahead of time to an economist friend. He did not like that sentence, but it's true that getting monetary policy choices right is more of an art than a science. With that said, economists have suggested a number of rules that tell central banks how to respond in economic conditions so as to keep inflation near some target. I generally find these rules useful in guiding policymaking, and I find them especially useful when they arrive at the same recommendation. Unfortunately, since these rules are coming from different economists, that's not always the case if they arrive at the same place. But they are useful, I think, when they do. And let me talk about one instance in which they do deliver. Most rules, I should say, do deliver the same recommended course of action. Let's take a look at the following scenario. The FOMC observes an increase in available measures of inflationary pressures and a decrease in labor market slack. That's the gap, that's why our term to refer to the gap between maximum employment and observed employment. And many monetary policy rules would recommend that the FOMC not ease policy further, and in fact consider reducing the level of monetary policy accommodation. And this makes, I think, it does not just come from a rule, it makes total sense as well. If inflationary pressures have gone up and labor market slack has shrunk, you're doing better on both your mandates. You're doing better on the price stability mandate, and you're doing better on the maximum employment mandate. And the answer then is don't ease further if you're doing better on both your mandates. That makes sense. So with that recommendation in mind, let's go back to November 2010. At that date, the FOMC took a significant policy step by announcing its intention to buy $600 billion of longer-term Treasury securities over the next 8 months. This was referred to in the popular media as QE2, Quantitative Easing 2. Until the most recent meeting in August, this was the last major policy step undertaken by the committee. What did the available measures of inflationary pressures and labor market slack, what one might call the mandate dashboard, look like in November? So in terms of inflation, I generally think that core inflation does a better job of tracking underlying inflationary pressures because it doesn't include highly volatile and transitory fluctuations in food and energy prices. In November, PCE core inflation rate over the preceding 12 months had been less than 1%, and it had decelerated throughout the year. Now, of course, a good mandate dashboard should also have some measure of the future course of inflationary pressures. And here it's worth noting that after having enacted the policy intervention of quantitative easing 2, FOMC participants expected core inflation to remain very low, less than 1.3% over the upcoming calendar year, 2011. Now, in terms of labor market slack, it's hard to find reliable measures of this key variable. But the FOMC statement makes specific reference to the unemployment rate as a gauge of labor market slack. So that's what I'll use in my notional mandate dashboard. So let's go back to November 2010. The unemployment rate at that date was 9.8%. Again, after having put in place a large-scale asset purchase, the quantitative easing, FOMC participants expected it to fall to about 9% a year later. That's what the mandate dashboard looked like in November 2010 when the FOMC did its last major policy action. How the mandate dashboard changed in August 2011, the last meeting 3 weeks ago? PCE core inflation rose sharply, From December 2010 through July 2011, the annualized core PCE inflation rate was over 2%. FOMC participants didn't submit forecasts. It wasn't one of the quarterly meetings where we do that in August. So, but if you turn to that survey of professional forecasters I mentioned earlier, the most recent one done right, I'm not sure exactly the time, done before the August FOMC meeting, it predicted that the core PCE inflation rate will average 1.7% in 2011 and 1.6% in 2012. It seems clear, inflationary pressures were higher in August than they were in November. And my own forecast for core PCE inflation is higher than the SPF's. On the other hand, my making my forecast after the policy action was taken. I expect that core PCE inflation will average around 2% per year over 2011 and 2012. So that's about inflation. Inflationary pressures definitely seem higher than they did at the end of November 2010. What about labor market slack? The unemployment rate was 9.1% in July of 2011. It was 9.8%, as I mentioned, in November. Again, we don't have forecasts from FOMC participants available for August, but the survey of professional forecasters predicts that unemployment will be at 8.6% in just over a year's time. Going to the August FOMC meeting, my own forecast for unemployment was a little more optimistic. In the sense that I do expect unemployment to be under 8.5% by the end of next year, by the end of 2012. But even with a more pessimistic SPF forecast, labor market slack is smaller than it was in November 2010, when the FOMC was expecting unemployment to remain at 9% in a year's time. So just do the comparison one more time. Measures of past and forecasts of future inflationary pressures were higher in August than at the time of the FOMC's last major policy move in November. Measures of current labor market slack, expectations of future labor market slack were smaller in August. Go back to the rules, and intuition as well, they suggest don't ease further because you're doing better on both your mandates. In fact, they recommend that the level of policy accommodation be reduced. Instead, at its August meeting, the FOMC decided to adopt a more accommodative policy stance. From March of 2009 through June of 2011, the FOMC statement said the committee expected to keep interest rates extraordinarily low for an extended period, quote unquote. And this extended period generally is interpreted as meaning at least for two or three meetings. In August 2011, the FOMC changed its statement to say it now expects to keep interest rates extraordinarily low for at least 16 meetings, 2 years. So given what I've said, it's not surprising I dissented from this action. Now I would be remiss if I didn't mention one subtlety in my discussion of changes in the mandate dashboard since November. I've been treating the decline in the unemployment rate as representing a decline in labor market slack. This view is not uncontroversial. From an accounting perspective, the unemployment rate can fall for one or two reasons. People can find jobs, people can stop searching for jobs. And much of the decline since November is attributable to people who are formerly unemployed choosing to no longer look for work. Nonetheless, it still seems appropriate to me to view this change in labor market conditions as representing a decline in labor market slack. Intuitively, people who are non-employed but not actively looking for work are less likely to apply for any job opening. However, hence a recent departure from the labor force imply, because fewer people are looking for work, there's less downward pressure on wages. Almost by definition, from an economic perspective, this means that there is less slack in the labor market. Now, the rise that I talked about in core inflation over the first part of the year is consistent with this view that labor market slack is falling. But some observers argue that core PCE inflation is only temporarily high because of the tragic events in Japan or transitory spikes in commodity prices. If they're right, the disinflationary pressures of 2010 should soon reappear. in the form of a sharp decline in current and expected core PC inflation rates. In that eventuality, if we did see a decline in core inflation, increasing monetary policy accommodation might be appropriate. I've argued here that the committee increased the level of accommodation, while standard rules would seem to call for standing pat or even reducing accommodation. What are the costs of such a move? The standard rules are meant to guide the economy towards the committee's medium-term objective. If monetary policy is consistently overly accommodative relative to these rules, the committee risks generating inflation higher than 2% for several years. As I've discussed, such an outcome could have significant consequences for inflation and inflation expectations, and future committees might have to endure large losses in employment in order to fix these consequences. So let me wrap up here. I mentioned that I dissented from the committee's last decision in August. Two other presidents dissented, and there have not been as many dissents in one FOMC meeting in nearly 20 years. So in my view, this level of disagreement reflects two aspects of the current situation. The first is related to the leadership of the committee. Chairman Bernanke strongly welcomes the airing of disparate views within the meeting. He clearly believes, as I do, that the United States is a decentralized central bank because we will get better monetary policy and decision-making is grounded in a wide range of views. And I think the chairman should be applauded for this approach to policymaking. The second is related to the nature of the economic data that we've seen in the first part of the year. I've described how inflation rose and unemployment fell. It's also true that real GDP grew at less than 1% in an annualized rate in the first half of the year. And the outlook for real GDP has slipped as well. Last November, my forecast for real GDP growth was similar to that of other FOMC participants. I expected that it would average about 3% per year and probably closer to 3.5% per year over the next 2 years. So I mean, from the end of 2010 to the end of 2012, I was expecting somewhere between 3% and closer to 3.5% growth. Now I expect that real GDP will average around 2.5% per year over that same period of time. Now, it's unusual to see an increase in inflation and a fall in unemployment occur when GDP growth is sluggish, so sluggish, and when the outlook for real GDP growth has slipped as much as it has. It's hardly surprising, I think, that there should be some disagreement about the appropriate monetary policy response to this conflicting mix of information. What about the future? As we go forward together on the committee, I see no reason to revisit the decisions of August 2011. The committee has included what I regard as a 2-year conditional commitment in its statement. I believe that undoing this commitment in the near term would undercut the ability of the committee to offer similar conditional commitments in the future. And this ability has certainly proved very useful in the past 3 years. So I plan to abide by the August 2011 commitment in thinking of my own future decisions. Of course, the case for any additional easing above that provided in August 2011 would have to be made on its own merits. And then, like the 19th century settlers in the American West that I talked about earlier, the committee will have to keep its eye on the future when deciding about what to do in the present. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm happy to take your questions.